Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Coming up on this episode of White Line Question Time.
You say this every week, why don't you, or if you can do better, why don't you do it? And I was like, right, I will. And that was it. The next week I turned up with four records.
Four records? That's not even 20 minutes.
Played both sides and literally was like, that's it. I know though. People always go, do you not miss it? And I'm like, are you fucking mad?
Oh no.
Why would I miss sitting pulling my teeth out? It's like Kate said to me the other day, as in Kate Moss, she was like, who's your new bestie? And I was like, sure, I know it was that Claire for a while. I was like, no, you're my bestie. She was like, no, who's your new bestie? And I was like, arguing with her over it. I was like, don't be jealous. You know, without giving the story away, what it was all I ever wanted to be was loved. And it always makes people want to cry because it was that moment that when I put that at the end of the book, Mikey was like, you want to end it on that? I said, yeah, that's it.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions, usually over three glasses of wine, but not today. My guest today has been sober and proudly so for, well, 17 years now. He is one of the original superstar DJs who remains the superstar's DJ of choice, playing for the likes of Madonna, Prince, Kate Moss, the Beckhams, even had a slot at Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's wedding. Born and raised on a council estate in Battersea, he began his career in clubland at the age of 16 as a doorman before taking on DJ duties after telling the club's owner that people were leaving because the music was so terrible and that, frankly, he could do better, which he did. A month later, he landed a DJ gig in New York, and bouncing between London and the States with best mate Boy George in tow, they quickly became immersed in club and music culture, and then latterly, a very heavy drug scene. At one point, he was earning upwards of £20,000 a week, and, well, he spent it as fast as he earned it, with lavish and hedonistic living, quickly leading to a very dark, difficult and prolonged drug addiction that he says cost him in excess of £1 million in terms of what he spent and the years that he will never reclaim as a result of it. After struggling with addiction for almost three decades, he finally found sobriety in rehab and is now 17 years sober, all of which is documented with disarming honesty in his best-selling memoir, I Don't Take Requests. As he recounts a life that makes for difficult reading at times, charting a really problematic childhood, sexual abuse as a teenager, his HIV diagnosis, and the dark, dark days of his drug addiction, as well as the kind of legendary bad behaviour, well, that's made him a legend in his own brunch time. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's DJ Fat Tony. So nice to see you. How are you?
I'm really well, yeah, really good. I've been exhausted the last few weeks because I was in Australia and I got back and I then got a head cold from all the flying because I was on tour. But other than that, I'm all right. I'm kind of feeling, today's the first day I feel normal again.
That jet lag is quite brutal. Put a cold on top of it, and it's like, I know we do sound like old people moaning about our health, but it's a lot.
No, but you know what? It never used to affect me in that way, and this time it really knocked me because I wasn't in one place. I was flying all over Australia, so there was like 10 flight internal flights.
Brutal.
And Australia is very big. It's not like you're going from here to Brighton. It's like it's like 4 hours, 5 hours here. And so there's an awful lot of internal flying. And then to fly back from Perth on the 18-hour non-stop with everyone else's germs, you're just inviting the devil in, really. You know what I mean? It's like, seems like a really good idea, but, you know, it kicks you.
And your body's seen some devils over the years.
Oh, 100%. You know what I mean? I've had every devil. I've invited every kind of devil in. Don't worry about that.
There's not enough sage, is there, in the world to smudge it away?
No, there isn't. No, I end up scaring them off, so it's fine. Yeah, they can't compete.
They really can't. I just want to say a massive thanks, because 2 years ago I came to one of your brunches with a ton of girlfriends. Yeah. Danced for 20,000 steps and had what felt like a near religious experience, in as much as it was just utterly joyous. And I was home by 12:30 at night. I came to a late brunch in London.
Went to the late one, yeah. You hit the nail on the head. It is joyous. It's a happy environment, a safe environment. There's no, you know, no one's there staring at what you're wearing or what you look like or what age you are. We've taken all that out of it. And it kind of is just about being in the moment and enjoying the music, which is what we all really forget to do.
Yeah, we really do. And it was from the moment you came out surrounded by these phenomenal dancers and drag queens. It was just a celebration of girls and gays.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to celebrate both of those things in this day and age.
Totally.
Do you get what I mean? They don't get celebrated enough.
But also, it just felt like somewhere that you can go out and it's a really safe space to just let go.
Yeah. And I think that's what I'm the thing that I'm the most proud about, Full Fat, is the fact that it is a safe space. And we've got something really magical there, in the sense of that, you know, you've got the people come and they forget about whatever's going on in the world for 6 hours, dance their tits off, and literally, and then go home. And it's, you know, there's never any trouble. There's never any bad feeling. Everyone leaves on such a high. I know we're doing a good job, because it exhausts me every week. Because the energy.
I get that.
That's what my job is, to thrive off other people's energy. And this week when I got there, I was jet lagged and I had a cold. And thanks to Sadiq Khan, our lovely Mayor of London, allowing 11 marches to go on in one day, the whole of London was at a standstill. So it took me 2.5 hours from my house, which normally takes 15 minutes, to get to the brunch. So I was exhausted and angry and all of those things. And I walked in, and because I'd been away for 3 weeks, the reception was just insane, and just the energy. Yeah, it was like a tsunami hitting me. And I just within 5 minutes, I'd forgotten about all of those things and was in the moment. And I think that's what's so good about it. Do you know what I mean?
Even the queue for cabs afterwards, when we came out, was just full of love. You know, it's people going, oh, wasn't that great? Oh, I love that record. Or, no, you get this next cab. Don't worry, I've got my friends to wait with me. It was just, the feels were all good. And you curate that. That's you know, that's your community.
We're really proud of it.
You know, which for an acid-tongued provocateur is quite an achievement. For a man that used to sour milk, you know, I think...
It really is.
Isn't
it? You know
what
I mean? But that's recovery. Mm. You know, that is it, that everything that I do and everything I have in my life today, all of those magical things don't happen just by chance. They happen because they're a part of a process and a part of a bigger picture. And, you know, what I put out in the world today, I get back. I put out good vibes, I get good vibes back. And you know, I truly believe that that's where change comes from. You know, I much rather today make people feel happy than I would make anyone feel sad, because I don't want, you know, I've had sadness breeds sadness. Hate breeds hate, love breeds love. And I think that if we all start loving each other a little bit more, and especially loving ourselves, that's where it stems from. The minute that you find that you're all right with who you are, then you're all right with everyone else.
Totally. Because, you know, the experience of going to a brunch with my mates and then diving into your book, that it was a dual personality. It was the two experiences didn't marry up in so many places, because your book is a really tough read and it's so honest. I mean, that is therapy right there for you and for the reader, actually. And I really applaud you for not shying away from the stuff that makes you look not good.
Well, you know, that's just that it took 2.5 years to write, because it started off as a totally different book. It started off as, you know, I wanted to tell my story. I wanted people to understand. There was a big part of me that wanted people to feel sorry for me, because I come from a place of victim. And as that process went on, the things that I felt I dealt with and I was talking about, I'd never dealt with. And as each chapter unfolded, we kind of had to go back on everything, because it started off like really like, you know, I wanted to everyone to like think I was the funny, the happy-go-lucky one. And as the layers came off, you know, there were some really awful things that happened in my life that I thought I dealt with because I never spoke about them. And when you bring that stuff to the surface, it kind of just makes you, puts you in this place of vulnerability that you either go down with or you go up with. And I went up with it, and I just thought, you know what, this book needs to be the most honest thing I've ever done in my life. And if someone had told me 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that the minute you get honest is the minute that you find true happiness, I would have laughed in your face, because I've never been honest in my life. I would, you know, as I say in the book, you know, there were times where people wouldn't even ask me the time because I knew I'd lie about it. You know, it was literally that. And, you know, the freedom that I've had from writing that book is just is remarkable, because I no longer have shame. I don't have shame.
And the shame must have been so all-encompassing. And actually, when you start to unpick the book, because I would imagine that what you entered into with that book was, I'm going to write a really witty, funny raconteur's showbiz memoir. And what you actually wrote was the blood and guts and all the gory details of how you came to be who you are today, which is somebody that you like. But in order to get there, you had to navigate a lot of really unpleasant experiences.
But you know what? You used the word like there. Like was, I always went through life wanting to be liked, and I always went through life liking so the majority of stuff that I did. Today, I love who I am. There's a difference between liking and loving.
That's so good to hear.
And at the end of that book, the last line of the book, which summed up the whole book, was, you know, without giving the story away, it was all I ever wanted to be was loved. And it always makes people want to cry, because it was that moment that when I put that at the end of the book, Mikey was like, you want to end it on that? I said, yeah, that's it. That's the last line, because I've gone through the whole of my life wanting to be liked, whether I made you laugh, I made you cry. All I wanted, being liked was enough. And it's not. It's not. Being liked was being tolerated. I don't need to be tolerated by anyone. I need to be accepted. And the minute I find it, because I tolerated myself, I didn't accept who I was. I didn't accept the way I was and the way, because when you accept the way you are, right, that's when real change comes.
Yeah. But I think also you stop liking yourself when you do things that you don't like. And when you're in the grip of drink and drugs and you're surrounded by really big characters, as you were at that time, it really is hard to learn to claw your way back from that.
100%.
Actually,
yeah,
it's a really, really good book. And you know,
thank you.
One of the great autobiographies I think of all time that I've harped on about for years came from the pen of one of your best friends, Boy George. Take It Like a Man.
Take It Like a Man is a genius book,
isn't it? Like, yeah. I would encourage. I always say to people, if you're going to read two autobiographies, read that and Quincy Jones' Q. Also a brilliant book, right? Because again, it's just, it's somebody not trying to please the reader or themselves. And I really enjoyed the book, Tony.
Thank you. One of the first reviews that came out was like, you know, was someone at the Times, and she literally said, you know, the only person that doesn't come out of this book smelling of roses is Tony. He doesn't gloss himself. And that's the vulnerability, and that's why you love him. Because I
But that's a risk that you took, right? Because you got to the point when the book came out where, like, you know, if you'd been to any of the brunches or danced on any of your dance floors, you loved Tony, you know, you loved Fat Tony. Or if you followed you on Instagram, because you had this kind of, you know, second coming during lockdown where you became the king of the memes. So you'd engendered so much good feeling, and then you dropped this book that really made people scratch their heads about, he's not a nice guy at times. He did some shit things, you know, and you share all of that. I think that's gutsy.
Well, I had to, because, you know, it's my journey, and, you know, that's got me to this point. That's got me to this point of acceptance and self-love, and the fact that I, you know, I'm getting married in a year's time. I have everything nice. That in my life that I have is because of the things I don't do. Yeah. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to be who I am today if I'm still carrying the smallest bit of shame around with me. Because that shame manifests into bigger things, and
it does.
You know, it dictates to the type of person that we think we are. And, you know, I'm just all about love today. You know, I'm not like this, and I ain't no fucking saint, as my friends used to call me. Yeah, when I got clean, Saint Tony. You know, the thing about it is it's I if I can make someone else's life at the smallest bit better by just being and doing what I do, then we're on to a win-win situation.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean?
It's all good. It's all gravy.
Yeah, it is all good. It is. It's fucking great.
Having read your book, I wondered if I could, for my first question, I've devised three questions for you.
Go on.
Really interested to hear your responses to all of them. For the first one, I wanted to walk through your life via the places that populated it. So question number one, let's map your journey. And let's start at the very beginning, Tony. So for question number one, we're on a housing estate, a council estate in Battersea. It was the Petri dish from which you grew.
Yeah, it really was, yeah.
Tell me about that place and how what happened there informed who you became and led you to my next place on the map, Soho.
So basically, you know, growing up on Dunstan Road, as it was is the name of it, on the Wycliffe Estate in Battersea, you know, I was born in Pimlico, and we moved over to Wandsworth, and then we moved from there. As my family grew, my little brother came along, we needed a bigger flat, and my mum and dad got this council house.
So mum and dad, you're one of three, right? Mum and dad.
Three brothers, yeah. Mum and dad. And my mum and dad got this council house, brand new council house on a brand new estate. So everybody moved in at the same time. So there was no hierarchy. There were no, we've lived here longer than you, this is ours. So none of that. Everyone moved in at the same time.
That's quite telling in terms of how that community moves forward together, isn't
100%, 100%.
Quite unique, unusual.
Because my mum's still friends with some of those people on that estate, and I still talk to loads of people that I grew up with from that estate, because you were all on the same level.
Yeah.
There was none of this like, oh, the new people have moved in. There was none of that. And everyone moved there at the same time. They all got to know each other. Everyone had big houses. It's, you know, it was a really good place to live. But, you know, for me, my elder brother was always in trouble with the police. My younger brother was the golden child, God's gift to my dad. You know, I was the naughty middle one, the gay one. And being on an estate in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, it was skinhead times. It was like, it was a very male-orientated vibe going on. You know, we just come from punk and we moved back into skinhead, and there was all of these tribes going on, which would, you know, primarily gangs of kids. And there was me. And I, you know, I tried to fit in. I could never fit in. You know, there was never a moment where I ever thought that I wasn't who I was. I knew my sexuality. I knew all of that from a young age. I had so many other factors going on that at that point in time, like I was being abused by some guy who I was working for at the age of 10. That was all going on whilst living on this estate. My mum got ill. My dad was suddenly discovered alcohol. There were so many factors to who I was, and it, you know, it could have gone terribly wrong.
But it kind of did for a while for you, in as much as the way you processed all of that was to find an escape through recreational drugs. I mean, when your mum had cancer, your dad drank his way through it, and you found a youth kind of, not youth centre, but you went and joined like a youth club, I guess. Was that what it was?
Yeah, it was. It was Battersea Arts Centre on Lavender Hill.
And the guy in charge of it for 4 years groomed and sexually abused you?
Yeah, he groomed me for 4 years. He gave me a job working for him as an assistant, like a Saturday
job. How old were you, Tony?
I was 10 to 14. And I was a very grown-up 10. I wasn't a young 10, don't get me wrong. I wasn't like some
kid. No, but you're still a child.
I was a child. And I can just see that's how my mind works straight away. I will go to that place of like, okay, well, I was in control. I wasn't in control. I was a 10-year-old child. But, you know, the thing was, it was done in such a way that he made me feel guilty that I was, because I knew my sexuality, you see.
Yeah.
I knew I was gay. He knew that I was gay. He preyed on the fact that I was gay, sexually abused me, and then turned it around on me, saying that I kind of instigated it because of my sexuality. And also because money was passing hands and I was working for him, it kind of just became very, very sordid and very, very, I didn't know how to handle it.
Of course you didn't. You're a 10-year-old child.
But it sexualized me at such a young age that suddenly I used sex and all of those things as bargaining tools and ways to get through life. It suddenly became ways and means to get anything I wanted. And it put me into such a, like, it's taken me a lifetime to get through it, really. I can pretend that, I dealt with this straight. No. I didn't.
I don't think victims of abuse ever do, Tony. It has such a long tail.
And but, you know, I won't use that word anymore as a victim, because I'm no longer a victim. I was at that point in time, and it served me very well for many years being a victim. But you know what? That doesn't sit right with me anymore.
You're a survivor.
You know, at the end of the day, he went to his grave being the victim. He was a very sick, horrible man that did it to a lot of other boys as well. And rightfully so, probably got his own comeuppance in the world. Do you get what I mean? But victim for me now doesn't sit right with me.
I get that. But I think as well, you know, you write in the book that at that time you were considered to be a problem teenager, disruptive, right? But you think of all what you were dealing with. No shit, Sherlock.
But you throw dyslexia into there, and you throw ADHD into there, right? Which wasn't ADHD in those days. You were just a little bastard. You know, that was it. There was no ADHD. You were a little bastard, and that was it. And, you know, I was uncontrollable at school. I was uncontrollable. I was unteachable because I couldn't focus. And suddenly I found this new way of feeling that could change everything, which was sex.
And everybody finds their device, right? Sean Ryder was on the show and he said for him that the only time he felt normal because of his ADHD was when he was on heroin.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I've just started drinking coffee a year ago, right? And it has this effect on me where it just like calms me, believe it or not. It doesn't send me irate. It has the opposite effect. But what happens is the addict in me will drink more and more and more of it. And then I get wired and then I hate the feeling. Then I'm like sitting with myself all day. Just like, oh, and like literally it's just spiraling me out of control, because it's that thing that you find something that actually takes away that in here, what's going on in here. The 24 hours, seven, you know.
Chaos.
Some days some days my ADHD can be a seven or a six. Some days it can be fucking 15 or a 20. Do you know what I mean? It really just goes. And when you find a substance that kind of just takes the edge off a bit, you start to self-medicate, whether it be sushi or whether it be caffeine
smack.
Or whether it be cocaine or smack or alcohol, any of these things that we find, we start to self-medicate. And before you know it, we've got a little problem going on.
Yeah. So by the time you cross the bridge from Battersea, over the water, to Chelsea, and then down to Soho. You must have felt like suddenly, you know, 80s Soho, a place where somebody like you could belong. Talk to me about Soho and how you convinced Rusty Egan that despite the fact that you'd never DJed in your life, you were the man for his super club. Because Rusty was the king of clubland back then.
Rusty was. Rusty and Steve, they were everything that clubland was. And that, you know, they were opening this brand new nightclub, super club at Lyceum. You don't get bigger than the Lyceum.
Is that where
Lion King is?
Yeah. Jesus, that was a club.
Yeah, that was a club on a Saturday night. And in those days, the roof used to roll back as well. And like it was revolving roof.
What's the one? Asperity in Ibiza.
Yeah. So they literally had that. And I literally went to him because I worked in the Great Gear Market behind him. He had a record cage in the middle of the Great Gear Market, which was like the hub of the King's Road. Everyone would come in and walk around and go out to be seen on a Saturday. I worked in there for many years and since getting kicked out of school. So I knew Rusty really well. Rusty knew me. He knew exactly what a loudmouth little git I was. And I said to him, right, I'm opening my new night on Saturdays as well. And Rusty was like, why are you doing that? And I was like, I kind of in those days was getting a name for myself at that point in time. And I said to Rusty, I'm going to start my own Saturday night. No intention of doing it, of course. It was just, you know, something to say. And he was like, well, why don't you work for us instead? And we can combine it. I was like, all right, then, yeah, fine.
And, hustler.
Off I went and started doing the door. And I was doing the draw every week and I was inviting people and I was literally signing my name on the back of invites and everyone would get in for nothing with them. Building up my brand. It was all brand building.
But it's that curation, right? It's bringing the right people to the right place 100%. And then sending them back out into the world to market it for you, which is what you still do to this day and you do it really well. But to kind of home, like a homing pigeon, go in on somebody like Rusty Egan, you know, if for anybody outside of London or who's younger than us old crows, Rusty was a bit of a kingmaker back in the day. He'd done the Blitz Club, the Wag, you know, he was everything that came out of the London club scene. He was kind of on either at the heart or the periphery of it.
They created the London scene in so many ways. Blitz, you know, Club for Heroes, all of those amazing venues, like, you know, in Soho, that everybody, like, legendary nights and where movements come from, came from Rusty and Steve. And, you know, to approach Rusty, aren't just as loudmouthed as Rusty. Rusty is like, you know, rah, 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 full steam ahead Rusty. And I kind of just like, you know, it's a case of, right, just go for it. And I said to him, every week he'd say, how is it tonight? And I'd be like, so many people leaving early. And he'd be like, what? And I'd be like, yeah, they don't like the music. And they had this deep, amazing DJ called Ian Dewars. At the time, was like top of his game. He run this label called DMC and they like used to do all the dance music. I mean, listen, you don't challenge Ian Dewars, right?
But you did.
I did. I was a 16-year-old and I said, the music's shit, everyone's leaving. And that was it. And Rusty said, you say this every week, why don't you, or if you can do better, why don't you do it? And I was like, right, I will. And that was it. The next week I turned up with four records.
Four records? That's not even 20 minutes.
Played both sides and literally was like, that's it. And that was it. And of course, I got everyone to come and cheer when I went on. And that was it. Rusty was like, right, you can play every week if you want to do it. And I was like, fine. And then literally 2 weeks later, Stephen Linnard, who, God bless his soul, passed away 2 days ago, who was at St. Martin's at the time, was a fashion designer. He wanted to start a new night on Tuesday nights at the work club called Total Fashion Victim. And he came to me, he was like, I want to start this night. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So me and him started Total Fashion Victim on Tuesday, which I DJed at, suddenly became my new residency. And then literally a month later, all the New York lot came into town, Steve Rebell, Andy Warhol, all them all were in town. They all came on the Tuesday night to the club. And the next minute I got been offered this job in New York to go over and do Total Fashion Victim there.
So within a month of your first event, your first night, you had played to the, you know, the equivalent of the same sort of tastemakers, but this time from New York with Andy Warhol, whole new York set. They then book you. And before you know it, you've got a transatlantic career with basically four records that you play both sides of.
And I literally would go and borrow records off all my mates and say, oh, can I borrow this? And like, you know, then I'd get all my mates to come and play on the night so that they gave me records. And, you know, and it's just snowballed from there. It was never a career that was chosen. I never thought, right, I want to do music. I want to do this. It was really a gift. It was given to me.
But these were places where you felt like you belonged. And then you found another place that I know has great pertinence to this day, Ibiza.
Oh.
Like you, I was going to Ibiza in the mid to late 80s with my parents at the time. It was unlike anywhere else. And I'm not a young gay man, but I understood, even as a schoolgirl going there, this is a place where anyone can be whoever they want to be.
You know, that was the beauty of it, because I went there and I suddenly, it was like, for a young gay kid going like 1983 to Ibiza, and to go to Coup, which is was privileged, which had it was the biggest club in the world with no roof on it, and
oh my god, it was so exciting, wasn't it?
It was incredible.
I saw Grace Jones there the first time I went to do like a PA. And
mind-blowing, right?
My mind was... I mean, I was Kevin and freaking Perry. Do you know what I mean? My mind was blown. And life just... It had such an impact on me, I can't tell you. And I go back every year to this day.
But just walking around the old town, it was just like anyone could be what they wanted to be. You had these amazing people dressed up and no one batted an eyelid, and there was no like, oh, my God, look at them. You know,
no, but you think about it, Tony, right? You'd go in at the ground level and you'd have all the drag queens or the kind of, you know, the Euro trash of the day, right? But you kept walking up the walls of the fort, and by the time, you know, within 20 minutes, you were amongst women who were still walking around in, you know, widow's black, living in the walls of the fort. Everybody existed really harmoniously and with great respect amongst each other. I hadn't seen that anywhere.
And then you went further up into the Dolt Villa. And the further up you went, there was a leather bar, there was a leather shop, there was a gay club called Amphora that was built into the gay, and everyone coexisted. And then at the very top was the gay cruising area where everyone went up to the top. And all the locals, no one cared, no one gave a blind bit of notice about anything. It's not like
there's
today.
No judgment, was there? No, there judgment. Wasn't.
You know why? Because there was no social media. There really wasn't.
I still don't think, though, that we would that scene couldn't have happened in London, or you know, and that was quite a liberal place. I don't know. It just felt exceptionally tolerant. You know, I remember, like, you know, we were like bucket and spade holidays in Ibiza.
Yeah.
But my mum and dad would take us to these nudist beaches, where we'd all sit there and get like our packed lunches out, and there was all sorts going on around us. Everybody was just respectful of what 100%. Was happening. Yeah. I don't know. It was just so special. And it's lost so much of that, which is a travesty. But it's still a very special place.
I went during lockdown and, you know, very fortunate to be able to go over to Ibiza during lockdown.
Oh.
And, you know, quite a few times, and just felt like it had the magic of the island again. It felt like all of that, you know, like the McQueen trainer and all of that kind of element had been taken out of it, and it kind of just felt very magical again and spiritual again, because it is a very spiritual place, and it still can be when you go to the parts of the island that you
go north.
If you want to find it, you can find it. Do you know what I mean there? And that's the beauty of Ibiza. And I just think that it will always be Ibiza to me. You know, I can go every season, come the end of at the beginning of the season, I love it. The end of the season, I'm like, oh, thank God that's over now for another year. But, you know, the thing about it is it's still Ibiza, and it's still that firm favourite of place, because I feel at home there. You know, without saying, it really pisses me off when I see people go, oh, go returning to the island when they've been once, or, you know, all that shit.
You get very territorial.
Well, yeah. You know what? It's just ingrained in me for so many years, and I'm not one of those like Ibiza heads in that sense. It's just that it has so many magical memories for me, and you know, special memories. Yeah. It has an awful lot of fucking bad ones as well, but I don't hold on to them anymore. I used to hold on to. I always held on to pain and never happiness. But now, as I've progressed in life, I think to hold on to happy times is so much more important than the sad times. Let the sad times go.
Ibiza
has all of those memories, and every year we make more memories there. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. Better memories now, ones that you can actually bloody remember.
Yeah, totally. That's the beauty of it.
The dark days, of which there were many for you, led you to a place that saw you turn your life around. And I wondered if you could talk to me about rehab, because 28 years of addiction, I can't imagine that it was your first rodeo in rehab, but the one that really cracked it for you was quite a long stay, wasn't it? 6 months?
It was actually my first rodeo.
Was it really?
Yeah. It was the first and last. And I made, you know, it took me fucking 28 years to get there. Right. And the way I looked at it was like, this is a one-stop shop. I'm never ever coming back here again. I'm going forward from this point on. And I literally, there were many, 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 many times that I thought, I can't do this anymore. And there were many, many better days where I thought, oh, fuck that. I'll stop when I stop, you know, because my disease of addiction was far greater than I ever was. And I was not in control of anything for a good, the last eight years. There was no control in any way, whether it be bowel movements, whether it be anything. I had no control.
I mean, we should explain here, this wasn't just recreational drug use. This had gone way beyond that. You were...
Oh, yeah, I was using every day. I literally used and abused everything I came into contact with. I had a really bad alcohol problem. I just had a problem. everything I came into touch with became a problem. And it got so severe in the end. Obviously, I pulled all my own teeth out and I had severe mental health, and I weighed 7 stone.
That was when you were smoking crack.
Yeah, and crystal meth, yeah, the last
Jesus.
Year. And where does it go when it gets that low? Do you know what I mean? You can't, there's only one place you can go. You either die or you go, you stop and you change. Stopping and changing was never ever going to be a decision I made. It was always going to be a decision that was taken from me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted so much, so badly to not be that person. It got so bad in the end that all, you know, every day I just thought about my own funeral, about dying. That was the next thing to look forward to. And that's not being dramatic. That was reality. That was the reality of what my life had got to. It wasn't a life. It was a survival. And, you know, one night, one little thing happened and the pilot light came back on. It literally was.
What was that?
So it was my ex-partner who... I'd been, you know, I'd lost my house again. I'd lost everything. I was living at his house, and he was an active addiction himself. It was chaos. It was absolute chaos. And I'd been missing for a week, and I'd gone back to his house that day, and I burgled his house, which is where I lived, but he'd thrown me out. And I broke the window and went in and stole his new jeans and his credit card and blah, blah, blah. And off I went again. And that night he came to the cross where I was DJing, still maintaining my job because it was a way and means to get what I needed in life. And I was in the green room, but rocking backwards and forwards, thinking, you know, just I'd already been missing for a week, you know, again. And I used to rock backwards and forwards thinking it was normal just to stabilize myself. And I remember sitting in there, and I had one tooth left at this point at the bottom of my mouth. Which I would play with my tongue constantly. And someone came in, my friend Edna came in and said, so-and-so's here, Johnny's here. And I was like, okay, how's he here? And he'd been barred from that club for many years for fighting me in there and everything else that I'd got on, the chaos of Tony-ism. And He came into the green room, and I remember sitting there thinking, I can't deal with this tonight. I can't deal with it. Bearing in mind, I was wearing his new jeans, his fake London jeans.
That you'd stolen from the house that you'd robbed. Yeah.
Yeah, that I'd robbed, thinking, I can't deal with this, being the victim. And I remember him coming over to me, and I just thought, and I literally sat there, and I couldn't look at him. And he put his hand on my shoulder, and I thought, what? And I remember looking up at him, and he literally looked at me and went, what happened to you? And that was it. That was it. It makes me want to cry, because it was that suddenly that I looked at him and I just started crying. I couldn't answer the question. And it was that moment. It was that moment that that little pilot light kicked back in, and I just was like, I don't want to do this. And I remember saying to him, I need to leave. I need to leave. And he was like, come on, let's go. And I remember Lee, who run the club, said, yeah, just go. It's fine. I'll get you covered. And I left. And then that was on the Friday. And I was with him all weekend. And I just was like, I can't do this anymore. And then I went to see the doctor on the Monday, Dr. Paul. And I said, I need help. And he literally said, I've been waiting for 5 years for you to say this to me. And I was like, well, why didn't you say anything? He said, because it's not my place. You have to ask for help. And then he referred me to a drug drop-in centre, and slowly but surely I started to engage in wanting to get clean. I didn't know how I was going to get clean or how I was going to stay clean. Because when you've gone through life measuring everything in drugs, you know, you don't buy this, you don't buy that, you don't go there, you don't do this, because you everything goes into you being high and living. That was kind of it, you know. It had gone from being a mental hold on me, it had become a physical hold because the amount of drugs and drink I was doing. They all went hand in hand, and it was a slow process. And then about 4 months down the line, I remembered thinking I can't do it. And I was still doing drugs, but not as many. I'd got it down. And then I went to this magical place called... which was a 12-step program, and I started engaging in that. And suddenly I started to get identification with people that were doing exactly what I'd been doing. And it was like, hang on, I do that. And, you know, that identification took the power out of that shame of who I was and how I had lived. And it wasn't long before I just thought, okay, I really got to get that change. And I was very fortunate to get myself into rehab. Don't get me wrong, it weren't like fucking top high-end rehab. It was a government-paid rehab in Bournemouth. And I went there for just over 5.5 months. And, you know, I remember the last day, Zoe, who was my counsellor, who I'm still in touch with now, and I work very closely with her, and went back and helped them train and do it, to turn it into to deal with chemsex and stuff. I'd be very, very... stayed in touch with all of those people because they were game changers in my life. And they said on the last day, you know, you can't go back to DJing and you can't go back to that relationship and you can't go back to London. And I was like, I'm not going back to any of them. I'm going forward to London. I'm going forward to DJing. And that's kind of why I knew I was never going to go back there in that sense. But, because it's always about going forward for me now.
Yeah.
You know, going back was not an option that would work for me. What would I get from doing drugs? What would I get from drinking again? Nothing. Yeah.
And look how much richer your life has been. It's like, what, 17 years, is it, that you've been
sober?
Yeah,
it's just so it's come up 17 and a half years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, it's a remarkable thing. Because it does get better. And better and better and better. I know that people always go, oh, do you not miss it? And I'm like, are you fucking mad?
Oh, no.
Why would I miss sitting, pulling my teeth out? Why would I miss that, just that, oh, no. I never, ever once think, oh, I'd really fancy a line or I'd really fancy a drink. No. My life's too enriched for that. My life's incredible. Yeah. I travel the world. I do so many amazing things. I can walk my dog in fucking Battersea Park. The simple things are the most amazing things.
Aren't they? Yeah.
The stuff when that you're goes present. With my the stuff that goes with my job and my career are all blessings, right? I'm very blessed to have that stuff. But the little things about going for a coffee with my partner in the morning or walking the dogs in the rain today. Yeah. Oh, God, it's raining. Oh, my God, what a blessing it is that I can be in that situation and be present in that situation.
Yeah. So nice to hear. So nice to hear. And I think if anybody is even having that internal debate with themselves about, do I have an addiction issue, just to hear this is... oh, so helpful. And if you're, you know, if you're friends with somebody or somebody in your family who you feel might be in the grips of addiction, share this podcast, because I think that yours is a brilliant story. When you think that somebody could never get better, you're the proof that yes, they can. And
well,
they do.
You know, every year I post the same picture from seven, literally the week before I got clean, because it's really important to keep posting that picture, because people come in on different chapters of your life and they see you. And they see this world that you're living in and they think, oh, you know, look at him or whatever. And I just want people to realise that however bad it gets, it can only get better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For question number two, I want to talk about some of your unlikely friendships. And we had a previous guest on the show who became one of your... more unlikely friendships. I'm going to play this clip to you now. I was listening to you explain your friendship with Fat Tony.
Oh.
Because you two are like the Richard and Judy of Instagram for me. The chats that have unfolded between you two on
That's
the gram.
That's an unlikely friendship, isn't it?
Isn't it an unlikely
the
friendship?
The most unlikely friendship.
How did you... is it true that you met him when he crashed his scooter outside your house?
Yes. So I'd seen Tony in Pimlico. Now, what had happened was...
Pimlico's where you live, we should explain.
Pimlico, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd bought the Sunday Times one day and there was this big double page spread. The most handsome guy, a story about him being a famous DJ, pulling his own teeth out on stage. Quite extraordinary story.
In the whips of his drug addiction.
Yeah.
It's not what he does at every gig, everyone.
He was in like the grips of a drug addiction, yeah. And I'm surprised, you know, and he's surprised he didn't die. He was so heavily involved with drugs. The most fascinating. And then I go to my local caf. And there's this crazy local cafe in Pimlico, and often you'll see Simon Russell Beale in there, or you'll see, you know, the odd MP in there or whatever. And I can hear this guy talking behind, he's going on. And then I realise he's in the industry, and I turn around, it's him. And I said to him, my God, I've just read your piece in the Times. It's absolutely fantastic. And he was all a bit cool with me. He was like, great. Oh, yeah, okay, cheers, thanks. Right, all a bit, you know, that's him. Anyway, we kind of just kept...
a diss.
Yeah. We just kind of kept bumping into each other. I'm not Kate Moss, you know, or Donatella Versace, am I? So
that's
his friends.
Yeah, that's his friendship group, isn't it?
Yeah, that's his friendship group. Uber cool. Anyway... I just kept bumping into him in Pimlico, you know, polite conversation. He was always very pleasant. And then the height of lockdown, I come up my house and he sprawled on the floor. And he's kind of like close to tears. He's really upset. And I said, you all right, love you? And I've fallen off my scooter. I went, come here, lift him up. And I'm thinking, ha, who's okay now? You know? I'm up there and I'm up here and you're down there. Anyway, we laughed. Anyway, I picked him up and we became the best of friends. It was a friendship that struck up during lockdown. And we used to meet, once the cafes and stuff opened, we meet every morning in a cafe. And it's wonderful because he's opened up a whole new friendship group to me. He's kind of put me on the Instagram map a little bit as well. You know, we were in the park one day.
Yeah, he loves you.
And I love him.
You can see... he adores you and he adores ribbing you and pulling strips off you. And he revels in you. I think he really does.
Yeah, it's a genuine love and a genuine friendship as well. He's the most loyal, kind friend you could have.
Oh.
And it's, you know, he's just a really good... but we're from completely different worlds. I remember he went to do Donatella Versace's party for Fashion Week in Milan or somewhere. And then he comes back and we're having a cup of tea in Pimlico on Lupus Street. And he starts like ribbing me and trying to lord it over me. I said, bloody hell. I said, you know, I bet you don't talk to Donatella like that, do you? I says, if you don't want to be here, sod off back to Milan, you know. And we have that type of friendship where we're very brutally honest with each other.
Excuse me, have you got off with Don Johnson? No, I have.
Yes, exactly. But he's the most kindest. And do you know what he's introduced me to as well? when all my friends were going raving and dancing, I was never interested. I was singing in clubs. I was doing cruises. I was into musical theatre. And now when I go to his brunches or wherever, oh my God, his music is euphoric. And he's taught me to get really, really excited about dance music and stuff. And I'm kind of a bit 30 years late to the party, but I'm loving it. I remember he did the Century Club and he walked out with all these dancers to Street Life. Well, I'd never seen anything so thrilling in my life. You know, the Crusader Street Life, but with a like pumping dance beat to it.
He's camp. He's taking the biscuit, isn't
it? I know.
Oh, there you go. How's
makes
that?
Makes me want to vomit.
You don't mean a word of that.
You know, yeah, literally. I do love her. I do love her. She drives me fucking insane. I love her. I FaceTime her every morning and every evening, or we go
do
for
you?
Coffee. Yeah, most days. Yeah, most days, because she drives me mad. I know, as soon as she answers the FaceTime, punch her. But you know, it's like a dance of allies. Oh my God, drove me insane. But you know, there's this real thing about her. What I love about Claire is she's a very honest, loyal friend. And she tells you when you're wrong. She always tells me, oh, shut up, when I'm moaning about something. And I do the same for her, you know. She looks out for me. And that's what I love about her. And I love her.
She's very decent, Claire. She's a very decent soul.
There's something really, really magical about how normal she is, right? Apart from her showbiz side, which drives me insane, and you know, which I you know, I love to moan about, and that's it. It works. And you
but
know,
she thinks
Jackson,
you've got an extraordinary showbiz side. She's like ribbing you about Donatella, and what's the part of her showbiz world that you can't get on board with?
She just, you know, her musicals and all her crap that she goes on about. You know, she loves a good musical, and she'll tell you about it. And I'm like, oh God, whatever. And it's like she loves a sparkly dress and a sparkly handbag. Do you know what I mean? That's Claire. You know. There's something magical about her. And, you know, it's the same. You know, another one is like Gemma Collins. Gemma messaged me randomly, asked me to DJ at a birthday party. And I've suddenly become really close friends with her.
No,
I
didn't see that coming.
No, but you know what the thing about it is? The thing about Gemma is she's so honest, right? I love her because she will tell you how it is. It will come out of her mouth and you'll think, oh my God, you're right. Do you get what I mean? And she's
another
one.
She truth bombs you.
She honestly, sure, if it's my birthday, if it's anything or engagement, there's been a knock at the door and something's been delivered from Gemma. You know, she's so thoughtful on every level. I spoke to her yesterday about her engagement. I was like, I hear you having a party. She's like, yeah, you're DJ. I've already told OK Magazine. I was like, I will, of course I'll DJ. I'd be really angry if I didn't. Do you get what I mean? But the thing about it is all of the, you know, whatever circle of people you mix with and you bring new people in. It's like Kate said to me the other day, as in Kate was, she was like, who's your new bestie? And I was like, sure, I know it was that Claire for a while. I was like, no, you're my bestie. She was like, no, who's your new bestie? And I was like, arguing with her over it. I was like, don't be jealous. But you know, it's like when you get like, say with Gemma, right, or Claire, everybody else, like, you know, the Edward Emmonfalls, you know, the editor of British Vogue, obsessed by a Gemma and obsessed by Claire. And like, you know, so suddenly, because they're in my friendship group, they suddenly become cool. Do you know what I mean?
There's nothing more cool about people, Tony. You do.
But there's nothing more cool about, you know, when I met Claire, for instance.
But how nice is it to make good people cool, right?
So amazing.
You're not hoodwinking anyone. Actually, what you're saying is accept everybody, even if you might not like the same showbiz nonsense that as each other, because there's good in people.
You know what? Claire and people like Claire Sweeney are who they are. And she's this fucking star in her own right, right? People in my world or whatever world, Claire is a major factor of my world now. You know, I speak to her every day. She is a part of my extended family. And, and you know, who would have ever seen that coming down the line? No one. But the reason that is because of her honesty and the fact that she's a real, lovely, honest person. And that's what we need in this world. And regardless of what they do, whether they be a supermodel or whether they be in Coronation Street or whether they work in the corner shop, if you see the magic in anyone, it doesn't matter what they do for a living. I love the fact that I've got that crazy Liverpudlian woman around the corner. As you know, some days I tell people she's not my friend, she's my neighbour.
You bitch. She's
like, but you know, the thing was, though, when we started doing, like, I started secretly filming her
for Instagram.
The rubbish that she used to come out of her mouth, like, she'd go, I'll be like sitting there, like, going, yeah, go on, tell me about your hair. She's like, £25, and like, just going on, like, normal stuff. And it was just, and I just like, I started posting it. And it was like, that suddenly her followed, went, she was like on 20,000 followers, and it suddenly went up to 80. Then it went up to 100, you know, and, you know, suddenly, slowly, everybody started falling in love with Claire because they could see the reality in her, the real person that she was. Do you get what I mean?
But the people forget, you know, that's why, you know, all those years back, she won Celebrity Big Brother. Did she win?
Yeah.
Yes, she did, didn't she? And the world fell in love with her because of exactly what you've just said. She's just a really lovely person. She's talented.
Totally.
You know, hardworking. A little boy, the way she raises that young lad.
Oh, Jackson's amazing. Listen, I love, me and Jackson are like that. I teach Jackson a new swear word every day. And it's like,
she's so grateful to have you in her world.
I'm like, what's the word of the day, Jackson? And he says it and she's like, she like rolls her eyes at me. Or like yeah, dancing your last name. What's your word of the day? Dickhead. And I was like, there you go. Go on. Call everyone a dickhead.
But don't you think that this is really important that we have people that aren't in our tribe, in our world, 100%. Right? Because that's how you learn.
And listen, you know what I do every morning? I sit and I have coffees with the scummy mummies, as I call them, right, to their faces, by the way. It's not down their back. All the mothers of Churchill Garden, all the women of the estate.
All the Pimlico mums.
All the Pimlico mums, I sit and have coffee with them every morning. My other best friend is a woman who lives on the other estate down the road. Her name's Harika. She's got four kids, right? Incredible woman from the estate. Just lost her mum last year. I've been through so much. My friendship with her is so strong, you know, and it's like, because she's real. She'll do anything for you. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I DJed at her wedding.
Oh, on the estate. That's nice.
In the youth club on the estate.
Fantastic.
And she was like, all my friends can't believe I've got Fat Tony DJ at my wedding. I was like, why wouldn't I DJ at your wedding? Do you know what I mean? It's like I got the decks for her. I paid another DJ to come and do the warm-up. I just like, because it was, she's a friend. It doesn't matter what she does. And all her kids, I love all her kids. Her kids are fucking brilliant. You know, that's what, it's about reality. It's not about what that person's got or what that person does. It's about who that person is. Yeah. That's what that is. It's about who they are inside. And you know, I see all these people every day and they're brilliant people. And they're in my life for that reason.
And I love that you can trot from DJing at her wedding on the estate to Donatella's to Kate Moss's to back to Coffee with Claire Sweeney. And
that's it. That's reality, you know. It's what I do for a living and what I do
love.
For love. I'm very, very blessed because they all blend into one. Yeah. And yeah, the wedding's going to be a very remarkable place because we're going to have those women off the estate with Elton and everyone else. And it's, you know, and that's how it should be.
So the last, I think one of the biggest weddings you've played at was Harry and Meghan's. So, I mean, like, this is the
I signed NDA on that, yeah. But, yeah. You know, yes, that was a big one. But I've done lots of other, I did Marc Jacobs, I did Edward Hemmenfold's, you know, the list is endless. I did Ellie Goulding's, oh my God, it goes on, you know.
And now you're mate on the estate, which is exactly as it should be.
And Harika's on the estate, on Tatchbrook Estate, you know, in the youth club. Because that's what it's about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Good for you. I love
that. Yeah.
Now, sticking with Celebrity Big Brother, I want to dive into my last question for you.
Yeah.
You're the king of curation, right? A DJ set is ultimately you curating music. The memes. Yeah. I would say you're a social media DJ. with your memes.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Yep.
So if I was to give you free reign to cast the next Celebrity Big Brother, who are you throwing in the house and why?
Oh, that's a good one, isn't it, really? Who would I throw in there?
Because you know them all, Tony. You know them all. I mean, I'm thinking Claire and Gemma should be in there straight away.
Oh, well, they've both been in there already, haven't they? And they're both they both mastered it in their own ways. I mean, Gemma Collins in Celebrity Big Brother went on to be 50,000 million memes, you know, running around the garden with ponies and you name it, she took it to that level. You know, so I would really like to put in there a couple of TikTokers just to show the world how fucking boring and stupid they really are outside of anything. I'd like to put someone like Diane Abbott in there. You know, so that she could show the world what she really is like instead of being victimized the whole time and bullied. You know, the thing about social media is and the world that we live in is, we're all guilty of posting those memes, but it goes beyond that. You know, and people get a bad rap for saying something off the cuff, you know, that they and social media will take that and run with it. So I'd like to put someone like Diane Abbott in there. I think she'd be brilliant.
For people to see who she is and what she's really about.
Yeah, because you know what? The thing about Big Brother is, you know, people do get to see who you are and what you do. Mm. I'd love to stick George in there because he didn't do great in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. He wasn't really himself. He was brilliant, but he wasn't really himself. You know, he needs...
Not the George you know.
Well, no, because, you know, the thing is, when I'm with George, we bounce off each other. He had no one to bounce off.
Mm.
So you saw a really negative side to him, a moany side to him, you know, because if he started tapping around me, I'd tell him to fuck off and stop, you know. It's like, oh, fuck off. You know, George is like, he's one of my best, he's going to be my best man at my wedding. And that's, of course he is. Cause he's one of my oldest friends, you know, in life. And, you know, he's one of the most loyal friends. And, you know,
you two have been through a lot together at very, you've been through a lot of the same experiences, but at very different times in your life as well. That's quite interesting.
100%, you know that. And it always comes back to how the fuck did we get here? Every time I've sat on Parliament Hill and asked that question before, when we both had court cases or when this has gone on or that's gone on, I'm like, how? And, you know, recently with the book success and everything else that's been going on, George has been really, really supportive of it. Mm. You know, a lot of other friends kind of shied away and were all like a very, you know, their jealousy comes out with a lot of things. And it never happens with George. George isn't one of those people. George is
so
really
happy. You'd like people to see the George that you are friends with as opposed to the one that went into the jungle. Okay.
Yeah, I'd love him to be in there. I'd love Kate Moss to be in there.
So would I, because I think that, I mean, listen, part of me really respects the mystique, but...
One of the most funniest people in the world.
She's funny. Look, I'm wearing her today. There she is, all the capes.
I'm telling you, one of the most funniest people on the entire planet. And the world needs to see that.
But I don't think she gives a toss that people don't feel that she has that need to be understood. She's cool with who she is. And I think that's really important. Throw one more person into the Celebrity Big Brother house.
Celebrity Big Brother, Naomi Campbell.
Oh.
Just for the fireworks.
Naomi.
No, well, me and Naomi don't talk, and that's a long story, but it would be really brilliant to have her in there just so we could just blank each other. It would be TV gold.
So you don't get on anymore, but you used to get on.
Oh, we do. She's one of my best friends. You know, we have friendship is about arguing, right? We all, if you don't argue with your friends, then they're really your friends. You know, that we don't always do everything that we want in life, you know, to please people. And so we're just doing this, plugging that in. So, you know, So I think having Naomi in there would not only build bridges, it would be television gold.
I'd love that.
Because Kate and Naomi together.
Fun.
Yeah. They'd have to run it for 3 hours a night, though, because they wouldn't get word in their choice.
Totally. I mean, Sharon and Louis are going to look obsolete next to those two.
Oh, awful. I love Sharon, but bye, Louis.
Tony, thank you. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Oh,
keep
you're
being
so
honest.
Welcome.
And keep playing those records. And I look forward to seeing you on one of your many dance floors. Thank you.
Please come and join us soon, all right?
I will. My huge thanks to Fat Tony, and honestly, his memoir, I Don't Take Requests, I couldn't recommend enough. It's out now and is well worth a read. And for more chat, why not dive into our back catalogue, where you'll find episodes with Tony's mate, Claire Sweeney. She's in there. Martin Kemp's there, talking about his time in the clubs of Soho in the 80s, as are Bananarama, who were right there with them both. And there's Reverend Richard Cole sharing his love of Ibiza and the nights he lost on the dance floor of the clubs there. So what are you waiting for? Dive in, hit download. Oh, before I go, one more thing. Remember, you can always find us on Instagram for all the latest about the show. We're at @whitewine_questiontime. And also, please hit the follow button on Spotify. It's really, really helpful in terms of us being able to find you. Thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.